Yeah, okay. So, Tomas, are you online?
Yes.
Okay. So, you want to start?
Sure.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers of this seminar series for the opportunity to speak. And I'm going to speak about work done some time ago in collaboration with David Brizuela and Guillermo Mena-Marugan from Instituto de Estructura de la Materia in Madrid. And the topic which I'm going to cover is the fate of inbound known from loop quantum cosmology in case of unhomogeneous models. This is some very preliminary attempt to look at what happens. So more precisely, from the studies of isotropic and more general homogeneous models in loop quantum cosmology, we know that in near Planck scale energy density, the discreteness of the space-time causes significant modifications to the universe dynamics, namely, at near Planck energy densities, there is an additional effective force which makes gravity repulsive, and in effect, the observed expanding universe seems to be just late evolution, late phase, late epoch of the evolution of the earlier contracting one, which bounced back when its energy density reaches the critical level. I'm talking right now about the slide 2. So, please switch to slide 2. Of course, this feature was obtained only initially for isotropic systems. It was generalized later for anisotropic but still homogeneous ones. And now there is a question, because the observable universe is homogeneous, then the question is, does this feature survive in presence of the unhomogeneity? And even if this feature, if the bounce is still present, then what actually happens to the unhomogeneity, whether we can say something about how the structure of unhomogeneity is related before and after the bounce. So the presented work is some very preliminary initial attempts to answer this question in context of particular model, which is a model corresponding to Gaussian toroidal universe with nearly polarized gravitational waves. Please go to slide 3, next slide, outline. So, first of all, I would like to say that the work is a really preliminary one. It's by no means the final answer. And in the process, several semi-heuristic or even heuristic constructions were used. So we are by no means definitive, by no means the final word in this topic. We just wanted to use the formalism which was available to check how far we can go, I mean, how much of information we can extract in the present stage of quantum cosmology, whether we can address the questions of standard cosmology already. So, the structure of my talk is the following. First, I will briefly specify the model, I mean, provide its definition, provide some information about gauge fixing. Then, I will briefly introduce the main ideas and construction of so-called hybrid quantization. These departures are not the parts of this work. I am going to just present easier work than by other people, but I'm going to do so because I want to show that the effective dynamics which I'm going to use in fact comes from well-defined genuine quantum theory. After these two points, I'm going to introduce the effective dynamics, in particular present the holistic ideas behind this construction, present the systems equations of motion which follows from this construction, and then I'm going to actually the two main points of the talk, which are the following: effects of homogeneities of the Wamsons, in which I'm going to address the issue how the homogeneities change the positions, the scales at which the mounts happen. And in the last point, I'm going to talk about the evolution of the homogeneities through the bounds in existing models. Next slide, please. Let's start with the model specification. So the goal is the three-tones model is described by the four-dimensional manifold, which has a product structure. Three-tones times real line, real interval corresponding to time. And the special metric on three-tones admits two healing fields, which are assumed for the model to be hypercipher orthogonal. That's why we are dealing with linearly polarized gravitational waves. And the metric of such system can be described just by a few elements. One of them is the norm of one of the healing fields. Second is the area of two-dimensional healing orbits. And the third one is one metric which reduces in fact to just scale factor when it comes to the degrees of freedom. And the metric induced on the manifold formed by the healing orbit. So further simplify the description, we can introduce coordinates, the time t, two coordinates along the killing system, the unhomogeneous coordinate theta. Further, we implement certain choice of the gauge. Here it's important to say that, in fact, the system which we consider in here can be completely deparametrized. Namely, it can be described as certain kinds of fields evolving on some well-defined fiducial background to some scalar fields with time-dependent potential, but through make a relation to be able to apply this kind of cosmology to describe the system of quantum cosmology, we don't deparametrize the system completely. The gauge system which we are using, in fact, is defined by the condition that the area of the killing orbit and the scale factor of the one metric induced on the manifold of this orbit are homogeneous functions. Once this choice is made, we use the canonical formalism, the standard trick of one splitting, the standard system of constraints. And if the this choice already made, most of the constraints are automatically satisfied. The only ones which are not are the partial averages of the diplomatic constraints generating the infinitesimal translations in theta and the Hamiltonian constraints. Next slide. The degrees of freedom. So the special degrees of freedom was selected to resemble somehow the structure used in perturbation theory. Namely, we had some homogeneous degrees of freedom and the unhomogeneous one. The homogeneous subset of degrees of freedom has in fact the phase space of the vacuum Bianchi-1 system, and also we can use the standard methods employed, for example, in quantum cosmologies to describe it then by Ashtekar's connections and triads, further represented by triads and connection coefficients. The inhomogeneous degrees of freedom are represented by some quantity called metric field. We'll see in a moment what it exactly is, and its canonical momentum p psi. Now the point is that there is certain freedom in defining this metric field, namely conformally scaling, and this freedom is in fact fixed by the quantization. Namely, it was shown by Alejandro Colucci, Jerónimo Cortés, Guillermo de Maruna, and José Bariño that when we apply the complete parameterization of the system, the metric field can be interpreted as local hierarchies evolving with respect to time provided by the area of the Killing field, of the Killing orbit, I'm sorry. And then one can quantize the system using Fermat's soft quantization. And in fact, the requirement that the evolution of the system is unitary. First, uniquely select the representation of the system. Second, it imposes a particular choice of the metric field. Okay, so once the metric field is chosen, we since its local field is a function of the unhomogeneous coordinate theta, the best way of describing it is simply decompose it onto the Fourier modes, which are psi m and psi psi m, and then define the complex variables which upon further quantization will correspond to creation and annihilation operators. So, therefore, from brackets can be the standard structure, standard value for such such variables. And it has to be emphasized at this moment that although the choice, the splitting of the degrees of freedom presented here is somehow based or inherited from perturbation theory, what we consider here is not a perturbative theory, full nonlinear structure of the system under consideration. So we don't do any perturbations. We really consider the exact, in a sense, dynamics of Bianchi of Golden Universe. Next slide, please. Metric and context. So just to focus on what I was saying about, especially the choice of the degrees of freedom. Here is the expression of the metric tensor, where I marked in green the homogeneous degree of freedom, and in red the unhomogeneous one. Structure is a little bit complicated, but in particular, we see that exponents, in, for example, in front of the sigma square and the, it should be the rho square, no, the delta square, are quite complicated, and one could think that one could choose the metric field psi, so it gets simpler, but it is in fact fixed by this unitary in quantum evolution. Now, given this, we can derive the constraints, and the homomorphism constraint has a very simple form in terms of A star variable.
If you see output, can I generate gamma tilde in the first line?
Excuse me, can you repeat your question?
The first equation is by is gamma, what is this?
So gamma tilde is itself determined, given on the second line below C delta.
Yes,
so it's just a function which is completely determined by
yes.
By C delta, by C, the degree of freedom C of C delta theta.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the Kamonsky constraint is has very simple form of just a certain quadratic function of A. Hamiltonian constraint is a sum of two constraints. The one corresponding to the homogeneous degree of freedom, and which is actually the complete constraint while the homogeneous degree of freedom are part of our put to zero. It's CH, and it corresponds to standard vacuum, classical vacuum, GMT1 system. The unhomogeneous part, CI, involves both homogeneous and unhomogeneous degrees of freedom, of course, but in particular, the unhomogeneous degrees of freedom enter there to two terms, H naught and H in, which corresponds to somehow free and interaction part of the Hamiltonian of the scalar field. What is important is that the unhomogeneous modes enter to the Hamiltonian constraint only to certain, defined in a certain sense, energy, total energy. Next slide, please. The hybrid quantization. So in the previous slide, I presented the classical constraints. Earlier, I introduce the structure of degrees of freedom. So now we can quantize them. And the quantization was done by Mercedes, Martin Benito, Luis Garay, and Guillermo Mena Marugan. And it's so-called hybrid quantization. So to specify it more precisely, the previous choice of the degrees of freedom inherited somehow following from ideas of perturbative theory, here is pushed one step further. Namely, the unhomogeneities are treated as a field, part of matter fields, which are living on the homogeneous background. And then we employ, in fact, different kinds, different methods of quantization for the homogeneous background and fields representing unhomogeneities living on it. Namely, following the previous works of, for example, of loop quantum cosmology, we employ loop quantization for the homogeneous degrees of freedom and standard quantization, Schrödinger type of quantization, for the unhomogeneities, which are known that is leading oncogenic space time. So let's focus for a moment on homogeneous degrees of freedom. The quantization of them is exactly the treatment of EMT1 universe in loop quantum cosmology. We select the lattice, which is original lattice of loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology. Then, in fact, the homogeneous part of the Hamiltonian constraints, if we can go for a moment to the previous slide, which is expressed in terms of trias and connection coefficients C and P. In fact, if we express in terms of exactly the trias and a curvature, field strength, which is a curvature of the connection. So if we can go back to the slightly present quantization is slide 7. Given this expression, we can now holonomize the Hamiltonian constraints. That means we need to re-express it in terms of quantities which, for which in loop quantum cosmology there are well-defined operators. That means either holonomies or fluxes, which in quantum cosmology can be represented by trias operators. And so once it is done, we of course have to pick the length of this holonomy, and this is done in a standard way, namely when promoting the field strength to the operator, we approximate it by the holonomy along some rectangular loops. And we just require the physical area of these loops to equal area gap. Of course, that leaves some freedom. And in particular, historically, there are few prescriptions in how to keep this freedom, how to uniquely choose the holonomy. And in fact, in our studies, we used the old prescription in which the length at given direction are the function of the trias coefficient corresponding to the very same direction. I mean, in fact, to the far faces orthogonal to this direction. This prescription has, however, some problems. In particular, it's not a physically correct prescription for the non-compact model. Essentially, the reason for using it was because at the moment when we actually performed the study, this was the only one evaluated. So once the length of the holonomy was fixed, elements of the Hamiltonian constraint can be promoted to operators. We can construct the operator corresponding to the constraint. And then, of course, there is a freedom of factor ordering, which is fixed here in such a way that trap orientations always separate. I mean, the negative and positive piece have no contact with each other. And once this is done, the operator is sensitized. Essentially, it's brought to the form similar to the evolution operator in the models of quantum cosmology with the scalar field. So this sensitization is explained in the last line of this slide. Next slide, please. Slide 8, the hybrid quantization second part. Once we have quantized the Young-Simon system, we still have to quantize the unhomogeneity. And here's the standard box quantization is implemented. In particular, the variables AN, AN star are promoted to the operators and play the role of creation and annihilation operators. We in particular select the complex structure such that these variables can play that role. Given the complex structure, we can construct the box space. And then quantization of the homogeneous elements of the unhomogeneous part of the constraint is taken directly from the empty one from the previous point. And to implement the same densitization to be able to write the densitized operator, which is a quite simple form. The homogeneous part consists of two products of three products of two operators each, which essentially are a kind of shift operators. Here I wrote theta I operator as di sine of di, where d is momentum canonical to v, and v is essentially di to 3/2. However, this should be appropriately symmetrized. So there's an issue of factorization in here. In the same way, we can rewrite the unhomogeneous part of the constraint. In particular, the free and interaction Hamiltonian of the unhomogeneity become operator. Next slide, please. Slide 8, the effective dynamics. So from previous slide, we see that we have well-defined quantum systems. We have the quantum constraint, which is well-defined operator. In fact, it has a well-defined domain of action, which I have not mentioned. So we can think about trying to construct some of effective descriptions of possible dynamics it can generate. Of course, here, this set is heuristic so far. We somehow assume that the dynamics generated by the quantum operator has some semi-classical factor, and that they will remain semi-classical for relevant for part of the evolution, in particular to the bound. And the heuristic construction is like standard construction used in loop quantum cosmology. Namely, we take the basic operators d, sine of d, theta, and in our case a and a delta m, and replace them just by their expectation value. In the process, in particular, we neglect the regularization of the inverse trials, because in previous studies, they were shown to be practically irrelevant. Of course, this this is a holistic construction, and one can think why we should cut it at all. Of course, it has to be to be really trustable. It has to be tested. It has to be checked, at least in some domains, in some short portions of evolution, that it really mimics the genuine dynamics. But we already have some argumentation which are hopeful, which allow us to believe its results, at least to some extent. First of all, such technique of construction effective dynamics was successfully tested against genuine quantum dynamics for simple systems, for isotropic, for homogeneous models, usually with one field just or just few fields. Then we can expect it to work for finite number of giving the freedom. On the other hand, what we have here is, of course, not the finite number of degrees of freedom, but countable number of them, and have like well-defined hierarchy. And this additional matter, degrees of freedom, has such a structure, namely, they are coupled only in pairs. The only the field corresponding to n is coupled only to the field corresponding to minus n. And the coupling between these pairs happens only through their energy. It happens only through back reactional, only gravitational field. Therefore, it gives some hope that this construction is still, to some extent, quite reliable. It can be applied in this situation. So we implement it. We replace the operators by the expectation values and obtain in particular the effective constraints. Again, the Hamiltonian constraint, which is just the product of eta. Eta are very simple functions, that eta I is vi times sine of vi of the momentum. In unhomogeneous part of the constraint fills the unhomogeneity only through H free and H interaction. Next slide, please.
Tomas, can I ask you a question on the slide 9, please?
Sure.
So, did you actually do the following, which is just ignore all the ans except, say, A1, A2, A minus 1, A minus 2, for example, and look at this quantum system and look at some semi-classical state, evolve it using quantum equations, and then compare the evolution with the effective equations? Is that what you have done? Or
No. The system was not set as a form. The only input which I wanted to mention, it was just when dealing with other models. For example, the matrix scalar field, the Higgs-Patton field, we already observed that this kind of prescription works. It was not tested exactly with this particular kind of potential which the field which appear here would have.
Okay,
particular exact form of the potential was not tested.
Thank you.
Okay, given the Hamiltonian constraints, we can derive the equations of motion, which will be just Anton-Jacobi equations. Here they have quite complicated form. I just listed them on the transparency to provide some general picture about the structure. What will be particularly important for us is that the equations for these dots, that due to these equations, the time derivative of this is always proportional to the cosine of the momentum of B, which is seen in the first and fourth equation. What is important about this the structure of the system is that if we put all the AM to zero, it reduces just to effective dynamics of the GMT1 system.
Excuse me?
Yep.
It's Laurent. I missed a bit of the beginning, but I'm confused about one point, is that you have inhomogeneity here, but you seem to have only one Hamiltonian constraint. So why don't you have a field of Hamiltonian constraints?
Okay, there was at the beginning partial fixing of the system. And if we can go to the slide, probably first, the toroidal model, we require that the orbit, area of the Killing field orbit, and the tail factor of the metric induced on the manifold of this orbit are homogeneous. And that automatically satisfies already on the classical level, all the unhomogeneous components of the diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian constraints. So the only non-trivial constraints which were left are the special averages of diffeomorphism and Hamiltonian.
Okay, but can you go back to this initial formulation and write down what this, you know, new type of loop quantization is in terms of the original constraints?
Hamiltonian completely, taking all the notes of Hamiltonian, not the bridge.
Yeah, taking a field of Hamiltonian and understanding.
I mean, there is some work which is partial progress in this direction. I don't exactly remember, but there was some attempt of writing the Hamiltonian constraints in terms of MIDI superspaces. But the level to which the work was done was just writing the formal Hamiltonian. So I don't know whether in this direction it can be done. However, in the approach, the gauge fixing is standard method. For example, in the homogeneous model, in isotropic models, we also use certain gauge fixing. That's why we can express the triads and connections by just coefficients. So it does not seem to be problematic.
My worry here is that the gauge fixing is with respect to a symmetry which is originally the initial constraint, whereas now you're modifying the constraint, so it's no longer clear that this gauge fixing is with respect to this new constraint. But maybe that's a part of discussion.
I'm sorry, but I'm not modifying the constraint.
What do you mean? The new quantization, you're changing the Hamiltonian constraint.
I mean, the effective Hamiltonian constraint is different than original classical one, yes.
Yeah. So you're modifying the algebra of constraints.
Well, I think you're right, Laurent, but I think we should come back to this at the end. But at the moment, I mean, you're right about the main point you're making. But the same thing is that at this stage, if you had done gauge fixing for infinitely many constraints and left with just two global constraints, then the algebra between these constraints is not modified, right? I think your point is that, well, if I had not gauge fixed at all, then I would have some constraints. And in that, I had gone and done the loopy quantization.
Yeah.
Then what would happen to that algebra? I think that's a kind of a different question that we can come back to at the end of the discussion.
Okay.
Then shall I continue?
Yes, please. Yes, please.
Okay. This system has some nice properties. For example, the theta rho and theta sigma are constants of motion. Furthermore, because of this constraint, it's just a certain linear combination of the quantities expressed in terms of A star, which are again constants of motion. So we have quite well control over the diffeomorphic constraint, and know in particular that once initial data satisfies, it will be satisfied throughout all the evolution. So the only burden on us on satisfying the diffeomorphic constraint is the appropriate choice of the initial data satisfying it. Next slide, please. The dynamical trajectories. Here is the plot which shows, in particular, one example of the dynamical trajectory. It's the contracting of the universe coming from infinite peak, bouncing Earth at row, then bouncing for the second time in P theta and going back to the original classical trajectory which is here presented as the red line. So red lines here are the asymptotic classical standard trajectories of the Gaudi universe, one contracting, one expanding.
Can you tell us the geometrical meaning of P theta and P rho for the audience? In terms of the factors?
Essentially, these are the areas of the special manifold is resolved. And then we have certain scale factors, which are the length of the circles in particular directions on the source. And the keys are always the the product of this length. For example, P theta is in fact the area of the orbit of the healing field. These are areas of certain resources which are slices of the spatial manifold.
So the spatial manifold is a three torus, and then in that three torus you consider certain two tori. And you are plotting what happened to the areas of these two tori and the dynamic evolution. And you are saying that in the classical case you get this red curve, and then that red curve goes to zero, presumably, the area distribution to zero, right?
Yes.
And in quantum theory, they don't shift to zero, but there is a bounce. That's what you're saying.
That's right.
Thank you.
So, for this example, we have again the bounds like in homogeneous situation. But we need to check to what extent the picture is a generic one. So please go to the
Hello.
Sure.
Yeah. In your previous plot, can you give some more details about what are the initial conditions which you have taken? Like, this is like an example plot. So maybe is this a typical plot or is this some?
Yeah, this is a typical plot. I don't remember the exact number. This is one of few dozens of plots, and right now, really, I cannot say. Like in the Planck unit, the theta's, which are constant of motions, are around 1,000, 3,000. Really cannot provide the details right now for this particular plot.
So the turnaround always in such is some general initial conditions occur around in this region.
This is a generic plot. And we'll show the genericity in the next slide.
Okay, so why I'm asking is because here the values of P rho and P theta don't look very large than the bounds occurs, right?
So yes.
One should, in general, worry also about the inverse scale factor effect. Like, one has to check that, because even if you take...
And in this plot, they are very large, right? Please remember that this scale is 10 base 10 logarithm of the variable. So
even then,
the inverse corrections here are negligible still.
Okay.
And anything above zero here is has negligible inverse bias correction.
Okay, thank you.
All right. How to check the genericity of the bounds? First, let us look at the situation when we have completely homogeneous system. All AMs are put to zero. Then the position of the bounds in each same direction of theta. In each direction of p, which encodes certain areas of tutori, is just given by the constant of motion theta, capital theta. In particular, there is a relation in the first line of the slide. And from there, and from the equations of motion, we can already say that if we have an homogeneity in the directions corresponding orthogonal to the healing field, the position of the bounds will not change. Why? Because from the equations of motion, we see that cosine of appropriate momentum, B, has to vanish. Then the sine has to be either plus one or minus one. Then we can use this very definition of capital theta, which is V times sine of V, to relate V with theta. And this way we obtain exactly this expression, which is in the first line, which is for homogeneous system. So for this direction, we have no problem, nothing changes. The homogeneous direction is a little bit more complicated, because in fact, the position, in fact, value of the parameter V, which is V theta to 3 half potentially, is given by this quite complicated expression. It's a maximal root to the equation I have written. And in fact, it happens to be a three-order polynomial in certain function of V theta. And then we have to take it. When two constants of motion, theta rho, theta sigma, have opposite signs, then we see that the part which is marked red has always magnitude bigger than analogous parts with all the unhomogeneities neglected. If we turn off all the unhomogeneities, S is just zero. Then we see that the unhomogeneities only can increase the red term. Therefore, because theta are constants of motion, for the same values of the constant parameters, for the same values of theta, these bounds will happen at bigger d theta. So there is no problem for opposite signs, constants of motion. But if the signs agree, then we have a little bit of a problem, because terms inside the red bracket will compete. And then, unfortunately, we have to check it numerically. So please go to the next slide, numerical study for the bounds. So why do we even hope to address this issue numerically? When we are in the system using standard of degrees of freedom, because the effect on geometry of the unhomogeneities is only through their total energy, H0, and certain energy of interaction. And we have, in fact, just two parameters. All the unhomogeneities just amount to two parameters. So we, in fact, have the finite number of degrees of freedom. To further simplify the problem, to make it more manageable, we partially compactified it. Namely, with the fact that, by definition, the interaction Hamiltonian is bounded by the free Hamiltonian, and we introduce the proportionality constant alpha. In the same way, we can somehow decompose the theta constant of motion, which are of which domains are non-compact. We can express them by the edge, which is the position of the bounds of the theta in case of homogeneous system, and some constant theta which encodes the somehow the asymmetry between the direction state of delta there should be rho. It's in the direction rho and direction sigma. So for example, if the universe has the same sizes or the areas of the torus in these two directions, then the beta is 1/2. And the closer it's to 0 or 1, the more degenerated the torus becomes. This range is only two non-compact parameters, free Hamiltonian and bound position of the homogeneous system, which we can deal with it numerically. Let's for a moment fix all the coefficients as with exception of H naught. Please go to the next slide. You may have kind of the bound one. This is what happens. This is the position of the bounds of the homogeneous system with respect to H naught. We see that initially, once we go out of homogeneous system, the position of the bounds increases, and then there is a jump, and position of the bounds actually becomes higher, further from the singularity than the original of the homogeneous system.
I mean, you have to explain a little bit about what is blocked. There are several lines there. There's a dotted line and two dark lines. So which ones are we supposed to look at? We are supposed to look at the solid line
because what is plotted are in fact solutions to the equation provided on the slide 12, the bound. And maximal solution is exactly the position of the bound. So what we should look like here, here are the all the roots of the of this polynomial.
And can you recall what is VH, please?
VH is the position of the bound of the homogeneous system. Like we have some homogeneous system. And then we take all the homogeneous data the same, we just put all the unhomogeneities to zero. And then we have some Young T1 universe, and this bounces at a certain d theta. And this d theta at which it bounces is the edge. No. Okay, I see the confusion. What is plotted here is, in fact, the theta. It's the bound position in theta of the unhomogeneous system. It is equal to the h only when h naught is equal to zero. Okay, so I'm sorry for the sake of the confusion. More precisely, what is plotted are the roots of the polynomial, which defines the bound point, and the bound point exactly is the maximal root.
So how many roots does this polynomial have?
It's a third order polynomial, so it can have up to five roots.
Right. So but here, what roots are you plotting? I mean, you're plotting the maximum root.
Yes, essentially. I mean, not only maximum root, because there are in fact two roots, or in some places five roots visible, because it's root for six H naught. So sometimes there is just one root, sometimes three roots, sometimes five roots, sometimes
so,
just.
So sometimes they're degenerate.
Yes.
Okay. So sometimes they're degenerate, and sometimes there are more roots. So I'm sorry. Now I think I understand.
Yes, and we always take the maximal one. Okay, so given six, all the parameters, VH, alpha, and beta defined previously, we have just one dimensional system, function of H naught. And then we think that above certain value of H naught, the homogeneous, the bound is always bigger than the homogeneous. and the area where it happens can be determined analytically. So to get the minimal value of the bounce, we have again just to scan the compact interval. So we do it for each value of dehomogeneous. Let's go to the previous slide. We do it for each value of dehomogeneous alpha and theta. We obtain certain function of three parameters this way, and we may simply analyze the behavior of this function. In particular, scan it for compact parameters, alpha and theta, and then to check whether it behaves sufficiently regularly, check also the limit as dehomogeneous goes to infinity. So if we go two slides ahead now to the slide numerical scan of the bounds 2, we see particular behavior of this three-parameter function. For example, for six-parameter alpha, it's quite complicated, but nonetheless possible to analyze. Next slide, scan of the bounds 3, for six-parameter beta. And for the numerical scan of the bounds 4, yes, next slide, is just single slice for six alpha and beta. So we see that although the functions look a little bit scary at the beginning, they behave in quite regular way. It is possible to find the limit, it is possible to find the minima, and the result of this scan is the following, is on the slide 13. Which is that the position of the bounds in theta is always not smaller than 5% of the bounds in case of the homogeneous universe. So we have lower bounds of 5% of the bounds of the homogeneous universe. In consequence, we already have an answer. That means the bounds is also happening, and it's well away from singularity, just at least 5% of the bounds of the homogeneous universe.
Okay. So let me just make sure for the audience that we understand what you're saying. So on slide 12, at the bottom, you consider two cases. The first case when the rho theta and rho sigma is less than zero, then you already knew that the homogeneity in fact increases the volume at which the bounds occur. The geometry is even more macroscopic when the bounds occur. So you have to look only at the next case, the other complementary case, when this product is bigger than zero. Then on slide 13, you did a systematic analysis. I have to say that I don't completely understand what was assumed and what was kind of followed from the equation. But my question is it the claim that in fact you have systematically looked at the second possibility and concluded that even when that product of the two roots is positive, as the product of the two theta is positive, in that case, considering case by case everything that can happen, you still conclude that in all cases, the bottom line holds, namely V theta of VB of theta is bigger than or equal to 5% of the same quantity of homogeneous case. Is that the conclusion?
Yes.
So there is no further assumption?
There is no further assumption except of one, namely, we are analyzing here this maximal root. And if we look at the plot of the numerical scan of the bounds 1, page 14, we see that everything really depends on the actual structure of the dynamical trajectory. Because we always ask about the maximal value with respect to given H naught. But we can see that for example, if it happens that the trajectory somehow follows the, for example, the dotted line, this way we would not get the correct answer. But point is that this is not the case. So if we go to the slide 18, called caveat. First part exactly states my doubt that we cannot take this result as reliable if the trajectory behaves in a wild way. But if we look at the actual dynamical trajectory, we see that they, in the range of parameters which is relevant for this scan, they behave more or less like vertical lines. So in fact, the approximation which we have used is a very accurate one. In consequence, this, although we assume that the dynamical trajectories are practically vertical lines, for the purpose of the plot on the page 14, this assumption is accurate.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. So this is one of the caveats which has to be taken into account. If we go to page 18, there is yet another caveat. Namely, if you look at the roof, they are in fact some kind of reflective boundaries. Whenever the dynamical trajectory hits the roof, it reflects. So in particular, it may happen that we have sequence of several concentric collapses, which is shown on the page 20, where we have example of such trajectory. And therefore, in principle, it may happen that through some kind of infinite sequence of the bounces of three collapses, we can go somehow down the throat between the roots and actually hit the singularity. This, however, would require fine-tuning. This is some kind of critical trajectory. It's not non-generic in the space of the initial parameters of the time evolution. Therefore, the bounce, in fact, even if we take this situation into account, is generic. Okay, so that was the result regarding the position of the bounce. So the second part was about what happens to the unhomogeneities if we go to the bound. And let's go to page 21. And to address this question, we know that H naught, the free Hamiltonian, is in fact a convenient measure of the energy of the unhomogeneity, because for asymptotically for large for asymptotic future and the asymptotic past is it approaches some constant value. And it is exactly the term which enters the Hamiltonian constraint. So in our case, it can play some role of the energy. Of course, the contribution of a single node, it will be encoded in the absolute values of An. Now we can just calculate numerically the evolution of the system and look how these values are related in the asymptotic future and the asymptotic past. And what we observe is that they change. The asymptotic values from the past differ from the ones in the future. And this change depends on the phases between complex variables an and a minus n. So it happens that the energy distribution this way may change when you go to the bounds. And change of this distribution depends on how the fields were originally aligned. So the idea to somehow describe statistically, for the, for example, analysis of the spectrum of the homogeneities, is to somehow forget about this phases. Then, if we remove this initial information from the system, it simply becomes then statistical. Then we can investigate it using standard Monte Carlo methods. And we did it, selecting the distribution of the energy of the absolute values of AN as the Gaussian distribution, and the uniform distribution of the spaces between them. For that, let's go to the next slide, it's 2022. So, in the analysis, there is one observation which is very helpful. Namely, if we just take the family of the dynamical trajectory, which differ just by the phase between two modes, we observe that energy change between asymptotic future and the past is a function of this phase, and there are two regimes, two domains. The regimes where H naught is large, where we call it an homogeneity dominated situation, where the bound is governed actually just by the homogeneity, then this function has zero integral. Integral over the phases of this function vanishes. Therefore, statistically, if the distribution of phases is uniform, this amounts to preservation, statistical preservation of the energy of the given modes of homogeneity. This situation changes a little bit if we consider the near vacuum state where H naughts are very small, where the universe is almost homogeneous. Then the average, the integral, becomes positive. And that means that, in fact, the energy of unhomogeneity is increasing. So bounds amplifies somehow the energy of unhomogeneity for as long as they are very small. So if we go to the page 23, it's an early attempt to analyze the statistical structure of the unhomogeneities when they are amplified, when they are not. And in fact, what we can see are two branches, are set of points near point 0,0, near crossing of the axis, which corresponds exactly to the unhomogeneity, to the near homogeneous system. And the line which goes below it, which corresponds to the system which is unhomogeneity dominated. Right now we don't know yet, because this is a preliminary result, what are these points corresponding to very high relative changes. They are the, most probably the artifacts of the numerics. They should not be taken into account, because actually the results were obtained by forcing the software for the symbolic mathematics to do the numerical work and to extract the results certain heuristic methods were implemented, and they are not working always perfectly well. So therefore, it's what to say that it's like. So to summarize, to conclude, we obtained, we considered two problems. What happens to the bounce? Is it preserved, and how the scale of the bounce changes? And obtained the result that the bounce is generic. The position of the bounce in two directions is not affected by the unhomogeneities. And in the unhomogeneities, and homogeneous direction, and size of some very small regions near critical trajectory, we have the bounds on the bounds on 5% of the bounds of homogeneous universe. So there is still bounds. There is still bounds at finite scale. It is just that it may be closer to the singularity than for homogeneous universe, but not closer than 5% of the original position of the bound. Second address problem was the evolution of inhomogeneity. And then we address the, we try to answer the question, how the structure, the energy distribution of the inhomogeneity for the gravitational wave changes to the bound. And then in the process of investigation, we discover that there are actually two domains of the decay. One, inhomogeneity dominated where the energy of the gravitational wave is statistically critical, and near vacuum where it is statistically amplified. Okay, that's all.
Can we come back to this issue of the constraints? So if I understood properly, what you have is that you start from a system where you split the constraints of usual gravity into homogeneous and inhomogeneous. Then you solve the inhomogeneous part, and then you deform the homogeneous part by localization. So I was wondering, what does it mean, you know, is it a consistent way of doing it? That is, if you think back to, you know, the full algebra of constraints in the beginning, what does that mean to do this procedure? Does it correspond to a procedure where you deform both the homogeneous and inhomogeneous constraints, or?
In a sense, yes. Although this result is visible only like indirectly, because in fact, what change of the homogeneous part of the constraint does, it changes all the evolution, it changes also the, it changes also the evolution of inhomogeneity. So if we take the trajectory and try to somehow, if we take the system and we try to again re-derive the inhomogeneous constraint which would mimic this trajectory, then, of course, this will be completely changed. I mean, all the parts are in fact changed.
Yeah, but it's not even clear that this will be a first-class algebra. Or because in the homogeneous constraint, there are parts of, you know, the homogeneous component centers. So if you start to deform them, I'm just not sure what it means.
I mean, I don't really understand, I have to say, the relevance of this question, because we are dealing with the structure, this effective dynamics mimicking some quantum behavior. So, okay, if you would like to define from the beginning the classical dynamics which would reproduce exactly this effective one, then, and we would like to solve it, then we have to worry about whether the algebra of constraints is first class, whether the constraints are of the first class or not, because then, if not, we would have problems with solving it, but this is not what happens here. We are going the other way around. We already have the solution.
Yeah, I know that you're avoiding that, but this is the key question, that is, if you have this algebra of constraint in the beginning and you start to deform it, then there's a strong consistency requirement, which says that this deformation should preserve the first-class nature of the constraint.
Yes, but I'm not deforming the algebra of the constraint. What I'm doing, I'm...
You solve the classical constraints and then you're deforming the Hamiltonian constraint. We agree on that. You're changing
it. Not even this. I'm quantizing it.
Take what you call the effective Hamiltonian. Okay, the classical version is a deformation of the original one. That's in that sense. And then you work at it. You work in the quantum level, but that's not the.
But Laura, I think your question is well taken. But it seems to me that it is a general criticism of Tepper. Depends on the viewpoint you take. For example, I can look at 2+1 dimensional quantum gravity that many of you have worked on, including me, many of us have worked on very much, as a symmetry reduction of 4-dimensional gravity, where there is a space like unit vector, which has constant norm. And now one can keep asking always the question, that wait a minute, but if I had done actual 4-dimensional gravity, and then done some gauge fixing, etc., would I have obtained the same result as I obtained if I had done the gauge fixing classically, gone to 2+1 dimensional gravity, and then looked at and then quantized the system. So I think the general question is always about whether, how much can we trust the procedure in which all but a finite number of constraints, or all but finite, are actually gauge fixed, and the remaining are then quantum mechanics. And that's a very good question. But it seems to me that it's a procedure that is followed in many, many cases, and gives us some insight.
But that's not exactly my question. I have no problem with, first fixing the gauge and colliding. The thing is that at the end of the day, you have a new dynamical system, and the question is whether this effective dynamical system is really the gauge fixing of something, which contains...
I can ask exactly the same question. That 2+1 gravity is the effect, is the quantum theory of 2+1 gravity obtained by appropriate gauge fixing for symmetry reduction of the 4-dimensional quantum gravity, and we don't know the answer to that question.
But in 2+1, we don't deform the constraint. So I don't think the question I'm asking does not apply.
It's not deformed. We are solving the constraint in some way, right? I mean, I can say that you are deforming the constraint because in 4-dimensional. Say, for example, if you do allow spin form, one is introducing some discretization, one is representing FAB as a holonomy. That's exactly corresponds to deformation of the system of equations. That is what happens here.
What I mean by deformation is just replacing theta I, which is Ti, by the new theta I, which contains the sinus. That's really what I mean by deformation.
Okay, but that's not
what I mean.
Okay, it's not just replacing some linear function by spine. So that's why I presented all the genuine quantum theories to show that it's not just that kind of procedure. It is, okay, it's not done in the systematic way. There is a lot of gaps. There's a lot of heuristics. But what we are trying to do is to build quantum Hamiltonian, to quantize the original classical Hamiltonian, then take out the expectation values on some semi-classical state. And that is what really gives this time. It is not that we are putting this time in the classical system. It is that our semi-classical states are believed to follow trajectory which corresponds to the Dutch modification.
I don't disagree on how you get there. At the end of the day, what I'm saying is that the effective dynamics you're looking at is the dynamics of the deformed Hamiltonian that you could get just by this replacement. Now, so if you look at it as a mathematical problem, you have deformed the Hamiltonian into this new by this deformation. And then I wonder, the question is whether this effective dynamics is the one of gauge fixing or control. But maybe you don't. Because if you want to do it, the question, if you want to do it in full gravity, you will not be left only with just one homogeneous part. So this question of whether you could do it while preserving the Hausdorff constraints is, it seems to me, a key question. So here you can avoid it, but it might be a good place to look at it.
I completely agree with you, Laura.
Yeah.
That it's a good place.
this Guillermo. Yeah, as I remember, you just look at the Hamiltonian constraint, only Hamiltonian constraint, and you make what Laurent is calling the deformation of the orbit per zero mode, then you can do exactly the same gauge fitting, okay? That appears here. So I don't know whether this actually answers the question.
One can do the same gauge fixing, and then the question is really whether the resulting quantum constraints you would obtain, and you go through the same procedure of obtaining the effective equations as you did here, then the statement would mean that there are infinitely many Hamiltonian constraints. And these are all just effective Hamiltonian constraints. And Laura wants to know if, in fact, the you get a first-class system of constraints. And I think that's a very good question. And I mean, it would give us a probe into this whole business about closure of a constraint. I mean, the first glimpse into the business about closure of constraint in the full theory. Yeah, I think that as it stands, the value of this kind of analysis from my perspective is slightly different. I mean, independent of the answer to the question that Laura is raising, I think this kind of analysis, provided you fill in the gaps of the effective equations and so on, is still extremely valuable for the following reasons. Namely, one might want to know that, well, I got an almost homogeneous system, and I got some small perturbations, which is what seems to be the case with a large-scale structure of the universe. And then I want to know, well, what happened to this particular system? And what I would like to avoid is doing kind of this linearized perturbation theory. But rather, I would like to do a fix a point in the classical phase space and look at some neighbor of that point and try to do, so to say, nonlinear perturbation theory around that point, just as geometric analysis people do very often. And so if I want to get physical insight into what is happening to that nonlinear neighborhood of a homogeneous situation, in that case, I think this kind of gauge fixing, where you avoid the deep conceptual problem and yet make some answers, my personal prejudice is to think that these answers are in the right ballpark, and one cannot trust them completely because we have not been able to derive anything from first principles. But I do think that they gave us a lot of intuition. So that is a general kind of value of this, which is sort of in two different directions. Laura's question is about what can this teaches about the mathematical structure of the full theory and the constraint algebra, etc. The second is second question could be, what does this kind of analysis teach us about what happens in homogeneity as you go through the box? And I think that the answers one gets are trustable for the second qualitative answers one gets are qualitatively trustable for the second class of constraint, the second class of questions.
Can I ask another question? This is Carla.
Yeah.
I was intrigued by this comment about the statistical behavior of the homogeneities when you go through the bounces that you get if you look out the phases. Is this discussed somewhere? Can this be related to discussions about entropy behavior across the bounds or something like that? Can you say something more about this?
Able to address the behavior of the entropy. Let me think, because in principle, the problem is that maybe not in realistic sense, because here the structure of degrees of freedom is still not rich enough. For example, for given say energy level, we still have only two-fold degeneracy. It's not like the degeneracy of the spherical harmonic. So if we want to get something applicable to the observable universe, probably it's not enough. But already we can think about defining some kind of entropy here, and even sufficiently precise analysis, statistical analysis, I would suppose this problem might be addressed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think you could just start by introducing a Liouville measure on this phase space. And I think we'll have to truncate the phase space probably with a finite number of modes for inhomogeneity. Fortunately, the structure of your equations is such that this is possible because it's mod a n couples only to a minus n. And then you could construct a Liouville measure, and then actually you will proceed it. And very heuristically, what Carlo is asking, I think, is that it seems to go in the right direction, because if initially there was large inhomogeneity, one might think that there is large entropy somehow. And then the statement is that if you average all these phases, etc., you will get some ensemble, and then you find that, in fact, the bounds doesn't increase the entropy very much. If the entropy is already large, it does not increase it very much. If, on the other hand, initially, situation was very homogeneous, then it would seem that the bound, initially the situation was very homogeneous, and therefore it would correspond to quote unquote some kind of low entropy state, then going through the bound seems to increase the entropy. So I think that seems to be compatible with the quantitative understanding of kind of what one might want the entropy to do. So it might be worth thinking. Other questions or comments?
Hi, this is Gulam. I have a question. Could you please go to slide 18? Then you make a comment that in principle there could be singularity. Could you be more specific about it? Is there a special condition where you have singularity?
Excuse me, can you repeat the question once again?
The question is that I mentioned in the slide that in principle it could go to singularity.
Okay, let's go to the slide 14, I think.
14.
The one, the numeric function of the bounds 1. Okay, the idea is that we should somehow think about the dynamical trajectories on this plot as almost vertical lines with slight oscillation. And then we see the situation where there is near V h equal to 100 and h not equal to 800, there is turnaround of one of the roots. And then let's consider the trajectory which passes very close this turnaround, hits the root below it, gets reflected, but during this reflection it gets slightly displaced, so it goes already below the upper root. And then in this way it enters some kind of a thought, some kind of way between the roots, which is for example the dotted line goes that way, and by infinite sequence of reflection from the root, in principle it can enter, just reflecting infinite amount of times between this root, can enter all the way down to zero. So this is this critical trajectory which I was mentioning.
So you're saying that there is a singularity for speed?
There will be singularity for?
For a special situation, like if you have an entire number of oscillations.
Yes, this is special situation, this is critical trajectory. This is exactly zero measure set on the space of parameters describing the solution.
Okay, thanks.
Is your argument that this could happen, or you know that this can't in principle happen? You cannot rule it out, or are you saying that this does happen?
I cannot rule it out.
The Gulam's question seems to feel that his assumption was that there is a singularity. And So the way I understood what you were saying was that you cannot rule out that there will be a singularity along this line. Am I right?
Yes, but this is non-generic. This is critical trajectory. And let me we cannot rule it out. We don't know whether these trajectories are actually realized, but we cannot rule it out.
Yeah.
Second, if this is effective trajectory, and if we take into account that this is quantum system, that it has some distortion, this result shows that most probably we cannot even enter that far, because the quantum state may disperse away, but it cannot go all the way, because it would require an infinitely sharp space.
Yeah, exactly. But I think I just wanted to point out, because Ghulam was assuming that even in the effective case, singularity does occur, and you are saying that we just cannot rule it out. And I also completely agree with your second statement, that if in fact you have some potential singularity along sets of major zero, then in quantum theory, these will be washed out.
Yes.
I would like to make a comment on this comment. So my comment is that I think that probably this also has to do with the fact that the Bianchi-1 quantization which has been used in this model has its own limitations, because I don't agree with Thomas that it's only for the non-compact models there that this model has problems. Like, one can show even for the compact model which has problems. So my hope is that if one does the right quantization, which is done by Abhay and his student, my hope is that this potential problem may also go away. So maybe one should check that.
That might be the possibility. In fact, this is sort of hope and belief that, because of some kind of energy considerations, that in fact it may happen that these flaws may not exist if we take this quantization of Bianchi-1.
Yeah, so just to conclude on this point, one can show for different matters that the Bianchi-1 quantization, which you have used specifically for this model, which is more for the educational reason, can have similarity.
The effective trajectory is okay.
Yeah, because the shear and the expansion parameters are not bounded.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So I'm not surprised actually that you see a potential similarity, but my hope is that with the correct quantization of Bianchi-1, this problem will go away.
It might be the case that with the second quantization, this problem will not occur.
Any other questions or comments?
Just one question. You have looked only here at the classical dynamics, so I guess you haven't looked at that. But there's a question about till when can you really believe this classical dynamics? That is, if you start from at late time, a very peaked state, which has very high degree of coherency, it might be, if you look at the fact that in some regime near the bounds, there might be, this classical picture might be completely drained off, because now the inhomogeneity will get lots of dispersion.
Let me address this question. We have already some lessons from finite dimensional systems that the bounds, for as long as it happens not in very quantum region like spiders of the Planck scale, the behavior is more or less like classical. The expectation values, the trajectories are modified, but this region does not increase the dispersion significantly.
So you would expect the same here when you have an infinite number of inhomogeneities?
Yes, because, to define the, this difference has sense only when energy of unhomogeneities is finite. then this energy, the most particular modes have to decay sufficiently fast. And therefore, okay, without the precise calculations, I would not like to make a statement about the contributions from the distortions to, for example, Hamiltonian. But my belief is that if it stays controllable and for one period of for one epoch of the evolution, then the some homogeneities don't increase significantly in the process of the bound. So it should be still okay if we go to the past, to the future.
Do you mean if if we don't go near this critical trajectory where the bounds goes down to zero?
Yes, of course. Then I mean, everything might happen because I would not simply not trust the classical effective dynamics for this near critical trajectory.
And I just want to add just my viewpoint, which may be just my own personal. I mean, what Kamal said completely, I agree with what Kamal said completely, namely that in the homogeneous and isotropic models, we have seen evidence, thanks to the very careful analysis that Kamal did, numerical analysis, that in fact the wave packets, which are sharply peaked at the late time, so to say, they remain sharply peaked on the effective trajectory, even around the bounce point. And this was a big surprise, but it actually is there. I mean, it's true. But I'm not sure how much of an artifact this is of the fact that in this model, a singularity has no wild curvature. The whole model has zero wild curvature. If the wild curvature were to become infinite at the singularity, I do not know if this is going to be the case. So, even without going to homogeneity, one can test this by doing a complete quantum calculation in the Bianchi models, because in the Bianchi models, the wild curvature does become infinite at the singularity. And my own suspicion is that in this case, in fact, the effective dynamics cannot really be trusted in the deep quantum regime, so to say, the Planck regime. But I don't have this numerical evolution has not been done. There's a group in Maryland of professional numerical relativists who promised to do it, but I've not seen any results there. If, in fact, it turns out that in the Bianchi models, the situation is what was in the Friedman models, that the effective trajectory is an excellent approximation, even through the bounds, then my confidence that, that even in homogeneity is in this case is that were qualified by Laura and by Thomas just now, there I could trust the effective dynamics. But I suspect that already in the homogeneous case, one might see that the effective dynamics is not so good near the deep Planck regime if one were to do this full quantum evolution.
Okay, I think I can add some facts which may provide some partial answers for that. Namely, recently I did some analysis with one of the students from Warsaw, and in a sense it's slightly weaker, in some sense slightly stronger than just checking the evolution of the dispersion. Namely, we looked at the global evolution from the point of view of asymptotic past and asymptotic future. And then we considered the LQC evolution as some, for example, contracting universe, which can be described by Euler-Lewis system, then evolving and producing, in a sense, like scattering into some other Euler-Lewis universe, which is expanding. And then we can compare the dispersions of those two. They are related, of course, by the LQC dynamics.
What model, what model are we looking at?
What I'm talking about is just isotropic, but I will go to the Bianchi one in a moment. And this, in this isotropic system, it happens that the dispersions were related by the strong triangle inequality. And it was not even assumed that the states are sharply fixed. It was, they are for physical states, they are just restricted by this triangle inequality. And when, at some point, the group in Madrid was investigating the vacuum guarantee one system in, unfortunately, in older quantization, so we cannot directly transfer these results to your quantization. But we did analogous comparison, and we also obtained certain inequalities which were a little bit weaker than the original triangle inequalities of isotropic systems, but nonetheless, they were there.
Whether the effective dynamics can be trusted at the plant, you're looking at X metrics, so we don't know if the effective dynamics is